This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Right, and I'm in favor of losing weight, but I have never encountered a diet that I'm willing to follow.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn.
Here I am, glad to be flying around with you today.
Checker, welcome back to the show. It's been a while since we've had you on.
Too long for my taste.
Yes, you've been traveling the world, I'm sure, since the last time we had you here. What are some of the big places you've visited on your world travels since we've had you on the show?
Sumatra, Galapagos, and New York City.
Very nice. And the most challenging visit recently, hosting 12 family members at your own house.
Right? That was a challenge. That was much harder than circumnavigating Sumatra.
All right. Now, the U.S. geography results from NAEP are coming out, we think, in a week or two. They're coming out soon, and we have a lot of concern that we may not be looking very good. Checker, you've always had a strong interest in this subject. So I want to quiz you right now. Can you pronounce the name of the city that will be hosting the 2008 Winter Olympics in South Korea?
In South Korea?
2018, did I say? 2018 in South Korea. Okay, here's how it's spelled. I'm handing him the name. Can you pronounce that city?
Pyeongchang.
Very good. Wow, I think that's right.
But you're sure not confusing with Pyongyang in North Korea?
Wow.
I really
that
doubt
is
the
impressive.
North.
Is that right?
That's the capital of North Korea, Pyongyang. And it's for real. And this one you might have made up.
No, this one is for real. That is where the 2018 Winter Games are going to be held.
I bet it's a fake city that they're just creating for the Olympic purposes. I'm not sure that South Korea is cold enough for Winter Olympics myself.
That's what I was thinking, right?
It's south, after all.
Right. Okay, good. Well, anyways, shoot, I wanted to stump Checker, and I failed. I failed yet again. Well, lots to talk about. It may be summertime. It may not be cold here. It's hot, but there's a lot of hot things to talk about in the education world. We will start with playing Pardon the Gadfly, and then we'll hear Amber's Research Minute. And then we'll have Chris's What's Up With That? Okay, so Daniela, welcome to the show. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Excellent. All right. This week's Education Gadfly has an essay by Checker about the need to tackle education governance. What's wrong with governance today, and how can we fix it?
Oh, and Checker, you have 90 seconds.
Governance and structure go together. Local control no longer works. Elected school boards are dysfunctional. Kids go to school all over the place, including in cyberspace. State governments frustrate local governments and frustrate federal governments and vice versa. The money doesn't follow the kids to the schools they end up in. The whole system wasn't constructed for charter schools or anything like them. It needs a total makeover.
Wow, pretty good. So the argument here is that many of the reforms today, including school choice, improving teacher quality, even certainly technology, online learning, they keep bumping up against these structural problems, and that we've got a system that is still designed from 150 years ago. We still do have those pesky local school boards and local school districts and boundaries and things like that, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in today's world. But how are we ever going to move past that, Checker? This is kind of woven into the American fabric.
Well, so was smoking once upon a time. We need to move past it. We're not going to move past it until we start talking about it, until we get something equivalent to the Surgeon General's warning on the side of the cigarette pack. Fordham's job here is to be the Surgeon General, is to point out the problem, is to get people focused on the serious impediment that structure and governance is actually placing in the way of the kinds of changes that our schools and our kids need.
So if we're the Surgeon General, I guess that makes you Coop.
In which Coop. Case, C. Everett Koop.
C. Everett Koop.
Yes, he's from South Korea, too, I think.
You need some kind of long beard, preferably. You
yes.
Look like the
and look
KFC
like a Mennonite.
Guy. Yeah. Okay. Good. We'll work on that. All right. Question number two.
Excellent. Awesome. All right. Question number two. An investigation has found widespread cheating in Atlanta public schools. How big a problem is cheating on standardized tests, and what should we do about it?
So, you know, there's always this knee-jerk reaction among reformers, ourselves included, that says, well, of course, you know, we have to be prepared for cheating. We need to set up safeguards, but you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I don't know. Are we not taking these issues seriously enough? You have a major urban school system that a lot of people thought was doing pretty good, where they have found widespread cheating in dozens and dozens of schools. I think the superintendent knew about it. Do we really think Atlanta's alone? I mean, is this another indication that testing has gone overboard?
any accountability system of any sort that carries high stakes for anybody is going to produce a strong temptation to fiddle with the data in order to come out better and either win the prize or avoid the punishment. And that's just as true of schools as of anything else. And if we're going to have a high-stakes accountability system with rewards and sanctions and interventions and so on, we're going to have precautions that minimize the tampering with the data. And tampering with kids' test scores is only the most obvious version of this. There's a million other ways you can fiddle with education data.
Right. And so in the world of, say, the stock market, there's all kinds of people whose job it is to go out and catch insider traders or other people who are finagling the system for personal gain. We don't have that much of an infrastructure in education to do that sort of thing.
Well, well-put-together testing programs really have minimal cheating. If you look at the amount of cheating that actually occurs on SATs, for example, it's really very small. Kids pay to take those tests. The tests are proctored. The papers are not revealed before the day of the test. And then they're instantly sort of sealed up and sent off to a distant location for scoring. All sorts of weird things happen in our school systems with state tests. I mean, the test papers sit around the school. People have access to them. Teachers have access to them after the kids are done with them, and so forth and so on. It's the high-quality test security is mildly expensive, but it is doable.
Now, one other argument is that, look, some of these schools, there's so much pressure on them, and the way that we have the system set up now, we have the system set up for these schools to fail. You know, if you've got lots of poor kids, and you're looking at their proficiency rates, if the tests aren't good at looking at value added over time, you know, invariably, these tests are going to give the schools a bad, you know, a bad name. So maybe if we got the testing right, if we looked at progress over time, if we had more realistic expectations, you wouldn't see educators doing this.
It's never going to be perfect. The fairer the testing regimen and scoring system, the less the temptation to cheat. A value-added system obviously is going to be fairer to schools such as you're describing than a single proficiency level, and will reduce the temptation to cheat. But particularly as teachers' own careers now begin to get attached to these test scores, it's going to get worse before it gets better. That is not, however, a reason to throw out the testing baby with the cheating bathwater. It's a reason to work to get the tests as secure as we can.
Okay, topic number three.
Okay. At their annual meeting this past weekend, NEA members approved a policy statement supporting teacher evaluations based in part on student learning, though they also pointed out that no current test would be legitimate for this purpose. Is this a significant shift or just a PR ploy?
So we're just talking about this, right? Connecting teachers' evaluations to test scores. NEA says, well, theoretically, but we don't actually see any tests that meet our requirements.
Right. And I'm in favor of losing weight, but I have never encountered a diet that I'm willing to follow. I think that this is a big fraud. This is a big PR job. This should not be taken seriously by anybody.
But, you know, do you see a shift in their language over time? It's similar on merit pay. They used to say that they were out and out opposed to merit pay, performance pay. Now the language says something about how they think the uniform salary schedule is the best method. I mean, you know, people who watch these things closely, it's like watching the Kremlin over, you know, back in the past, say that these things matter. These things, there's shifts. They're eroding their opposition to some of these reforms.
Well, once upon a time, the NEA had a president named Bob Chase, who was actually pretty savvy about how to talk about the need for change. But ever since he left, and you know, they do have a lot of turnover there, unlike the AFT, they've been brain dead when it comes to education reform. And they must have finally hired a PR firm that is helping them learn how to talk about reform without meaning it. The AFT has been way ahead of them in talking about reform and occasionally meaning it for a long time. I think what we're seeing is the NEA is now beginning to talk about it and not mean it. If the AFT is speaking Latin about reform and the NEA is speaking Pig Latin about reform.
And one more news from the NEA convention. They endorsed President Obama for re-election.
No, you must be kidding me.
Are you shocked?
I am devastated. I thought it was Palin for sure.
Now, but here is, you know, a president who has not always towed the party line on education, and he has said things and done things that they hate. So what's the lesson here? Is it for Democrats that basically, hey, you do whatever you want, the union will have to rally behind you at the end of the day?
Yes, that's the lesson for Democrats, that you do whatever you want within reason. The serious issue is whether they sort of sit on their hands in the general election and don't help much and don't contribute much. But who are they going to endorse? They're not going to endorse any of the Republican candidates in view as yet today. And this is the only port they have in a storm they're not very happy about.
That's right. And they're going to be very energized to vote out of office some of the state legislators who, you know, voted to end collective bargaining and other things.
And governors and a bunch of congressmen.
That's right. And so, you know, that's going to get them to the polls. And I think while they are there, they are likely to pull the lever for President Obama.
I think they will.
Okay, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing, Daniela.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Always glad to be here.
So a little nervous, you know, you got Checker here.
I know.
Boss on the show.
At least he's not going to comment on my outfit or my jewelry like the Rickster does, I'm hoping.
Well, let's find out about that.
All right.
Okay. Okay, what you got for us this week?
All right, this week we've got a new study out by NBER that examines whether the ACT predicts success in college. As we know, many college admissions offices use ACT scores as a criterion for college entry. Analysts used information provided by the Ohio Board of Regents to examine data for all students who matriculated in 1999 to a four-year public college in Ohio, which ends up comprising about 13 universities and 26,000 ACT-taking students. They separate the test into the four subject areas, math, English, reading, and science, to determine which ACT subjects are most and least aligned to student outcomes. Findings: higher scores on math and English tests are correlated with higher high school and college GPAs and lower college dropout rates. Reading and science scores provide virtually no predictive power regarding student success. These findings incidentally hold when controlling for student demographics, college major, selectivity of colleges. Finally, they find no evidence that using just math and English subscores would have an adverse impact on minority admission rates or admission rates by gender. They conclude that using reading and science tests as part of the admissions decision obscures the predictive validity of the ACT and causes students to be inefficiently matched to schools, meaning some are admitted to schools that may be too demanding or too easy for them. My two cents, aspects other than ACT scores, race and gender are important considerations in admitting students to college, and how students perform in science, for instance, might actually be useful regarding their potential career paths. So a lot there.
Woo.
Woo. Yeah.
What do you think, Checker?
I think that reading is probably a prerequisite for English, and so I'm guessing that that distinction doesn't really matter much in the real world. As for science, if colleges took science seriously, then maybe how students did in science before getting to college would matter in how they did in college.
Well, that's interesting. That was always President Summers' complaint about Harvard when he came in, was that they didn't expect much of students on the science front, and so you kind of skate by, take a couple of, you know, rocks for jocks classes. And
I did that myself once upon a time at Harvard, but I don't think it therefore matters whether you come in well prepared in science or not.
Right. So the answer is not to just, let's forget about teaching science because that doesn't matter for college and career readiness.
It's let's fix the colleges, which is so often the answer to so many issues in elementary, secondary education.
Right. Because when they interviewed the colleges, they all said we just look at the composite score. And clearly, you know, it'd be smart to look at the various scores on these four subtests. I mean, presumably because you want to use some of this information for where are their skills strongest, you know, what kind of career paths might they make. I mean, a lot of college freshmen have no clue what they want to do in life. So some of this could be used for other purposes other than, you know, are you going to drop out?
Right. Checker, let's go back to this. So, you know, there's all this talk about college and career readiness right now, saying that, you know, if we get kids into and through college, we have succeeded as a K-12 system. And now you're saying that, well, maybe that's not true because the colleges are broken. I mean, aren't we just keep moving the goalposts?
I've felt for a whole long time that the colleges are broken, that they expect very little upon arrival, that they have no way of measuring what you learn while you're there, that they send people out into the world having majored in ridiculous things half the time, and that the college graduates that we check out at Fordham still, for the most part, don't know how to write a decent paragraph.
Oh, you mean the people that do not make it into our ranks of the
ones we don't hire.
Yes.
What about all those people that say professors need academic freedom? It's different when you're a professor versus a K-12 teacher.
Well, I was a professor once, and a lot of my colleagues used their academic freedom to spend a good deal of time in their gardens.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, Amber. So what song goes along with this?
So since we're talking about student success in college and beyond, we have Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now by Starship.
Looking in your eyes, I see.
Did you like them more as Jefferson Starship or as Starship?
I like Jefferson. I'm not too interested in Starship.
You're referring to Thomas?
Of course, the Jefferson.
Okay, good. All right, and now it's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that?
Chris, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back after the week off.
Yeah. So, Chris, this is exciting. Your chance to shine. You know, you spend much of your day serving as Checker's assistant, but now he gets to see you in your most glamorous role.
Well, let's hope I can impress.
Okay, here we go. What are you reporting on today?
I've been doing this segment for several months now, and I have to confess that after all the time I've spent searching for ridiculous education-related news items, I now rarely find myself actually surprised by what's out there. More often than not, what I come up with leaves me shaking my head. Many elementary schools hold field days for their students toward the end of the school year. A field day, not unique to any one particular place or country, is an opportunity for young scholars to participate in outdoor games, activities, and other athletic endeavors. Field days often attract the attendance of parents and guardians of some pupils, excited for a rare opportunity to see their youngsters in the school setting. However, parents at Scaleby Primary School in Newby, UK were left aghast when they were told that they were not allowed to take pictures of the events over fears that the photos might be seen online by pedophiles. What's up with that? This might be one of the most over-preventative measures I've ever heard of. Do you really think that in the rare chance a pedophile did see a photo labeled Scaleby Field Day, he'd think to himself, wait a second, you mean to tell me there's a bunch of children in that primary school building? It's not as if students are wearing clothing with their names and addresses embroidered, so newbie should really relax and let parents save these memories. If they haven't already, this school should really do away with yearbooks and class pictures as well, because you never know when a pedophile might find it.
So, you know, Chris, it is depressing. You go out looking for these weird stories and they always end up feeling kind of ugh.
Yes. It just, I don't know.
Yeah. So the point here is that our sort of legalistic culture, our overprotective culture here.
This is UK, mind you, UK.
Yes, as in UK, invades us. I mean, what do we have to do? Checker, do we just have to tell schools to just relax, tell uptight parents to relax? Or, you know, is this just a natural defense? People saying, look, if something horrible happened to one of our kids, then, you know, we would feel bad and we would be blamed. And so we're going to take every precaution.
Well, it sounds like we should probably put all our kids into witness protection programs or possibly make them wear their Halloween masks all year to school so that nobody can recognize them. I mean, yeah, there are risks with absolutely everything that goes on in school, including the fact that a kid in a 100-yard dash might fall and get a concussion. That's a risk. Is that a reason to stop having kids run? I don't think so. You do some things that have risks. Everything you do has risks. You try to minimize them. But if you stop everything on the grounds that something bad might happen, you're going to end up doing nothing at all.
You know, this is I've become such a believer that one of the main reasons we need school choice in our system is for these sorts of issues around school culture and norms. I mean, you basically, in my view, you want to take all the really anal parents and put them in one school together, okay? And then you can take the more laid-back parents and put them in another school together, and they can each have a school that meets their needs more perfectly. So if the anal parents want to have a no-photo policy because they're afraid that these things are going to happen, fine. That's their choice. And if the laid-back parents want to say, you know what, we're not going to stress out about this kind of stuff, fine. But, you know, what we do is we're trying to push all these parents together in the same school, and they fight about things like this.
And the policymakers try to satisfy everybody and end up basically satisfying nobody at all.
Right.
But I think the notion of putting all the parents, anal parents, into, we might call it the sphincter school, I think that's it's not a bad idea at all.
I wonder which schools in the D.C. area would count for that. What's the sphincter school of the Washington private school market?
Oh, it's probably Catholic. I'm not sure. I don't think it's Sidwell Friends.
It might be St. Albans.
It might be St. Albans, actually, or National Cathedral School for Girls.
Yes. St. Albans, you know, which produced Al Gore. Take it as you will.
So. Take it as you will.
Okay.
Wherever you like.
Wherever you like. All right. That is all the time we have for this week. Thank you, Checker, for joining us on this special edition of the Gadfly Show. Chris, thank you. Until next week,
I'm Checker Finn.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.